Lecture 10, The Moral Point of View.
How do we know the difference between right and wrong? How do we go about classifying acts as good and evil, just and unjust? What should the power of tradition be in guiding our moral judgments and in shaping our moral sensibilities? If it was good enough for Uncle Harry, should it be good enough for us? Is the mere venerability of a practice a sufficient warrant for continuing it? What are our debts to the past, and what are our obligations to the future? Now, these sound almost like questions that would be raised in the course of a contemporary political campaign. Should we go to war? Should we bomb so-and-so? Would it be right to do this or that? This was a part of the ancient debate that the classical Greek world had with itself. In the pre-classical period, in the age of Homer, right and wrong are not quite as clearly articulated and defined in the terms we would now use. Sometimes you think that the mere fact, well, although it wouldn't have been regarded as mere at all, but the fact that the gods were disposed to have something work a certain way is in fact what made it right. In fact, the ancient Greek word for justice, dike, D-I-K, the long E, originally referred to a bifurcating path. And the right path was simply the path that the gods would have you take. So an action was the right sort of action when it conformed to the will of the divinities, particularly the will of Zeus. Medieval period, we'll hear that the will of the prince is the law of the land, and this is simply the application of that kind of reasoning to an essentially monarchical form of political organization. What the king says goes, do you see? There are even events in Iliad that reinforce this view in a quite peculiar way. You might remember the sort of celebration after Troy has been vanquished and the Achaeans have now assembled on the shore and they're getting ready to go home at long last, and they have these celebratory games, and they, of course, sacrifice the usual hecatombs of oxen and all that. Some wine is flowing, the evening fire is going. They have chariot races, and prizes are given. And interestingly enough, the prize doesn't go to the charioteer who came in first, because the charioteer who came in first actually was not known to be the best horseman, and after all, the prize should go to the best horseman. And so here you see this sort of struggle to determine the grounds on which merit is acknowledged and rewarded. If one knows that Smith is by far the finest horseman, but didn't win this particular race because of some crafty maneuver by somebody else, or because there was a banana peel or whatever, well then, if the prize is for the best horseman, well, then it can't just be based on who won this race. So there's something of a dilemma here, and I think it shows a certain dilemmatic quality to thought about right and wrong, good and evil. This now is a perspective forming, but not yet fully formed. Of course, by the time we get to the philosophical age of the Greek world, these questions are now going to be addressed quite directly. In Plato's Republic, there's a wonderful encounter between poor old Socrates, who's really on the ropes at this stage of the game, and these young Turks who keep peppering him with questions. They're entirely skeptical about the moral theory he seems to be spinning, and they've just about got him cornered. Glaucon and Thrasymachus and Adeimantus, here's old Socrates talking about virtue, and is there one virtue or many, and men of gold and men of it, all that, and there's a pause here, and his interlocutors, Glaucon and Thrasymachus and Adeimantus, say, what are you talking about? What are you? This doesn't have anything to do with the conduct of people. This isn't why people do what they do. This is some sort of philosophical, airheaded, going up in a balloon kind of. You know why people do what they do? They do what they do for the same reason Gyges did what he did. What? Who? Gyges. Yes, the myth of Gyges. Yes, the myth of Gyges. So now, within the Dialogue Republic, we're going to be treated to the myth of Gyges. Now, who is Gyges? Well, Gyges is out there working in the field, and the earth opens up, and Gyges looks down, and there's this large, hulking figure, maybe dead, maybe sleeping, whatever, almost godlike in its proportions. Hand is sticking out, and there's a ring on the hand, and Gyges, ever the opportunist, pulls the ring off, and then the ground closes up again, and Gyges has the ring. What does he do with it? Well, he's off at one of the municipal buildings. He's paying his property tax or whatever. And as he sits there in a room with other people, he turns the ring and he disappears. And he turns it the other way and he reappears. So he can make himself disappear or reappear at will. All he has to do is play with this magical ring. What does he do? There's Adeimantus, you know, he's looking at Cyrus. Well, what does he do? What does he do? You know, he's hectoring him, you see. And we're told what he does. He makes himself disappear. He goes off to the palace. He kills the king. He rapes the queen. He takes control of the realm. And Socrates is told in no uncertain terms, he does what anyone will do if he's sure he won't be found out, which is to say, he does what he damn well pleases. The reason we act the way we act is not out of considerations of virtue, but out of considerations of reward and punishment. The beginning, middle, and end of all moral discourse just is reward and punishment, fear and desire. There's no more to it than that. You know, sort of parenthesis, you old fool, close. I mean, you do get the sense of a taunt here. And you wonder how the old boy is going to recover from this one. Of course, Socrates, I mean, I sometimes feel very much as if I was the fly on the wall in that one. You can almost feel Socrates saying to himself as this banter goes on, am I destined to be surrounded by such nits as these? The point he wants to make clear to his interlocutors is that the question never was, what do people do? The question always was, what ought people to do? And if you're going to use the myth of Gyges, let's remember how Gyges ended up. He ended up in a state that was absolutely deplorable. So if we're going to settle these things mythically, at least tell the whole story. Of course, most people do what they do because they're fearful of what will happen if they don't, or because some prize or reward is held out if they do. This is what gets the ordinary citizen out of bed in the morning and back into bed in the evening. This comes as no surprise to Socrates. It would come as no surprise to anybody who gives a moment's reflection to the matter, a moment's thought to the matter. But this certainly can't be the beginning, middle, and end of the story. Because many people between getting up and going to bed do all sorts of things that we would be prepared to condemn even if they enjoy doing those things. We don't say, I mean, just to, I hope I don't ruin your lunch with this, we don't say that the best understanding of the conduct, the best moral account we can give of Dahmer's behavior is in terms of cuisine, do you see? That he just happened to like eating his victims, and the reason we don't do it is because we prefer other kinds of food. You'd say that someone understanding things at that level had not begun to understand things at all. The act itself is wrong, and if you were to derive pleasure from doing it, that would simply compound the moral failing. Not only would what you have done be the wrong sort of thing to do, but you're doubly damned for having enjoyed it. So again, the question isn't what gets people to do what they do? The question is, what ought to get people to do what they do? Well, famously, Socrates, Plato, had a theory about the order of events that take place when an act is going to be the right kind of act. The psychology of Plato, a kind of Platonic psychology or Socratic psychology, has our psychological apparatus sort of like Gaul, you know, divided into three parts. There's the rational dimension to human nature. And that's supposed to rule, do you see? The end of the day, the course of action is the one countenanced by reason. We are also passionate creatures. In several cases, Plato tells us it's very much like a pair of stallions. A good one that really gets you where you want to go, and a wild one that would pull in every which way. And of course, the task is to make sure that the wild one comes to conform itself to the behavior of the good one, to get passion lined up with the rational orientation, do you see? And the third component is a volitional component. It is willing. It's not just feeling. Passion in the Greek sense really is a passive kind of thing. It's more something that happens to you. And you've got to have a kind of resolve so that you will stand behind the dictates of reason. It's expressed perhaps more clearly by Aristotle when he talks about reason having not a tyrannical rule over the soul, but a kind of princely rule. It's the good counsel of the good lawgiver. And of course, you can always resist it. Otherwise, you'd be an automaton. It's the very fact that you can resist the counsels of reason that record your moral freedom and therefore your moral blameworthiness. You're blameworthy precisely because you have it in your power. You have it in your willfulness, either to comport yourself according to the dictates of reason or to comport yourself according to the summons of passion or emotion, the lusts, the senses, and the like. Now, Aristotle, given that view, has to ask himself, well, look, suppose Gyges, he doesn't raise this particular question, but he's getting at this kind of issue. Suppose Gyges had made himself disappear, and as he went off to kill the king, his chariot happened to knock over a large cauldron of water, such that it put out a fire that otherwise would have burned an infant to death. Now, this is not Aristotle doesn't offer this. I'm simply doing this for your amusement. Would we have any reason to applaud Gyges? Would we have tributes for Gyges? Would there be a triumph, a parade formation? Obviously not. We would say that, in fact, this rogue, we know what he was up to. Lucky for the infant that the chariot knocked that thing over, but no praise attaches to Gyges for this. And the reason no praise attaches to Gyges for this is we know what Gyges' intentions are, which is to say the moral judgments we reach are based not solely on consequences, but on purposes. And it's very much to ancient Greek philosophy that this distinction is sharply drawn between consequences, desirable or otherwise, and intentions. Intentions that reflect what? They reflect the character of the actor. And this is why Aristotle comes to conclude that a wicked person cannot do good acts. It matches up very nicely with the part of Aristotle's Poetics in which he says that what tragedy is awful things happening to a good person. Because when awful things happen to an awful person, there's nothing tragic about it at all. So there's a kind of dialectic, do you see, between the character of the individual and the moral character of the act. I want to say not a dialectic, I want to say a complementarity. It is the good person who does good things. And when good things don't ensue, it's not as a result of the moral weakness of the actor, but of factors the actor could not control. Aristotle makes an important distinction between actions that are voluntary, actions that are involuntary, like a patellar reflex, do you see, and actions that are non-voluntary. And it's useful to pause and to consider these things. The example Aristotle does provide is this. Suppose you're raising a subscription for some, not for some charity in that age of ancient Greece, but you're for some production. And you've got a list of people you're going to visit, and you're going to try to get some funds from them for this. So you're going through your list of 10 or 15 people. Now, as it happens, you pass by the house of a friend of yours. In fact, he wasn't even on the list. You're visiting this person because he's a friend of yours. In the course of that visit, and discovering why it was you were making the rounds, he says, oh, by the way, let me make a contribution. Now, in this case, we would say that you're getting funds for this worthy enterprise. In that particular case, was non-voluntary. You didn't set out to do that there. Nonetheless, it happened. Now, we can't say that it's involuntary in that you had no choice in the matter. It's to say that this particular solicitation wasn't an intended one. So there is a difference between a voluntary and a non-voluntary, an involuntary and a non-voluntary act. Another example Aristotle uses is the ship is going to go down unless the cargo is jettisoned. The only way the captain can save the ship and the crew is by throwing the cargo overboard. Now, do we want to say that the captain wants to throw the cargo overboard? It's an interesting question. Aristotle wrestles with this question. In fact, he says, look, at the moment he actually starts pitching the stuff in the water, well, of course, we have to say he wants to do it, or at least he intends to do it. But it's not a primary intention. It's the necessary correlate of what is primarily intended, which is saving the ship and saving the crew. Now, I offer these as examples of the depth and the analytical rigor that ancient philosophers bring to bear on what are otherwise the activities of daily life. And why are they doing this? Why does anybody do this? What's the purpose of this kind of inquiry? The purpose, of course, is self-perfection. The purpose of an analysis of this kind is first to know the kind of creature one is, and then to see what one can do about it, and within the limits imposed by that nature. Now, does this mean that the Greeks were interested in what it meant to be Greek? No, the Greeks were interested in what it meant to be human. And for all the derogatory references to barbarians and the like, there's no doubt but that the dramatists and philosophers of the period thought that what they were unearthing were facts about human nature, which you would find anywhere and everywhere that human nature has an opportunity to express itself in its fullness. This is why Aristotle argues that wherever there is anything even approximating a rule of law, communities of an otherwise quite limited and politically negligible character, still, the principles of equity will be the same. Basic principles of fairness, he says, are going to be the same everywhere. He says the principles of equity are universal and everywhere the same. And in the sentence that follows that, he takes a passage from Sophocles' Antigone. It's wonderful how Aristotle deploys Antigone to make this case for the universality of jural or juridical principles. Antigone, you know, was voted by Goethe and a number of the figures of German Romantic idealism as the instantiation of love in its purest and truest form. This is the love a sister has for her brother. The brother in this case is the recently deceased Polynices, whose dead body is left out exposed for the dogs to work on. King Creon has declared Polynices to be a traitor and commands that this body be left untouched. It's not to be buried. This is a terrible thing in the ancient Greek world. Generals were brought up on charges when they would leave the bodies of dead Greek soldiers behind in battle. So burial is a fundamentally important matter here. Now Antigone sits with her sister and says, we've got to bury our brother. The sister says, no, you don't seem to understand. Creon is serious about this. We touch that body and that's it. Yeah, she said, I know Creon is serious about this. We have to bury our brother. I don't want any part of this, the sister says. Antigone says, okay, so be it. Then you don't have any part of it. And she goes and buries her brother. And, of course, she's brought before the king. And there's Creon with all his might, his sceptered power. Don't you know who I am? Did you not hear the order that I gave? Don't you know what fate will befall one who violates the command of the king? Do you see? And there's little Antigone standing before his royal highness. and making clear to His Royal Highness that the precept according to which a sister will bury her dead brother is grounded in something more ancient than kings, do you see? That this is something she would do if the gods themselves opposed it. Now, what kind of claim is she making? I should point out that there are two views of Antigone's defense. One is that she's voting for tradition over the mere Pickwickian predilections of this particular king. Some have argued that this is simply Antigone invoking the notion of ethos as the basis on which we do things. Aristotle didn't think so. Aristotle probably has as good an authority on understanding Sophocles as anybody else does. Not only doesn't Aristotle think so, but it really isn't the turn that Antigone is giving here. She's not just saying we've always done it this way, because after all, we've also always obeyed kings. She's saying that there's something moving her. I'll tell you what I'm fairly confident is going on here. Antigone is yielding to something chthonic rather than Olympian, something ever more basic, matriarchal, feminine, generative. You see that I've referred to these things in a previous lecture in this series. In any case, what Aristotle finds Antigone pleading is a principle judged by Antigone to be universal, and in virtue of its universality, it cannot yield to this or that king. Now, there's something more to it than that. There's a good reason why there's a logic to this. How do you get kings in the first instance except by way of the fidelity people are prepared to have, fidelity to kings, do you see? A willingness to comport oneself according to the command of the king, which is to say, in another way, a fidelity to law. Not just a fear of what might happen to you if you disobey. Antigone doesn't want to be killed by King Creon. She's fearful. She's therefore greatly courageous. She's saying, in so many words, for there to be kings, one must honor this deeply ingrained, this instinctual, this utterly human impulse to do the right thing, to be moved to do the right thing, even if it means disobeying this or that particular king. You can't even have a rule of law unless you have beings prepared to commit themselves at the level of fundamental principle. And that fundamental principle is found within oneself. It's not merely a habit. Now, Aristotle knows, I mean, Aristotle is satisfied that what's being invoked here is not some notion of habitual Hellenic practices. He says when it comes to these matters, it's not the ton patrion. It's not the fatherland always does things this way. It's the ton kalon. It is to be committed to doing what is good, do you say? Not just what is ancestral, but what is good. And this presupposes the ability to distinguish between A, well, we've always done things this way, and B, this is the right thing to do. Now, of course, if we didn't have this ability, we would be beyond the reach of praise and blame. If all we could do was reflect a conditioning history, if we were simply constructed by a set of social conventions and reinforcements, if B.F. Skinner is the last word on morality, then how can you blame anybody? It's not surprising that in B.F. Skinner's book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, the slogan in it is, no praise, no blame. Well, at least Skinner is consistent. If, in fact, our actions are entirely determined by a reinforcement history, then it's quite preposterous to praise or blame anybody, because what they do is ordained by the history of rewards and punishments. The ancient Greeks thought differently. I'm inclined to say they knew better. Aristotle knew, as well as anybody else, the potent influence that early child rearing has. Every Greek knew that polis andra didaska, that we're taught and shaped by the polis, that social forces work on us from birth till death. But at the end of the day, we have this volitional component. Socrates puts it very well. He says, look, we're very much like toys. who can be manipulated as if we're on strings. The gods can move us every which way, do you see? We're like puppets. But there's a string we can pull back on, you see, which the puppet can't. And he calls it the golden string of reason. There's a rational power that we have that gives us the capacity to deliberate and to choose a course of action that matches up with something we understand at a cognitive level, at a rational level, something that matches up with a principle worth adhering to and being faithful to. And it's that that separates us from the world and the life of the mere automaton. Well, is this a vote then against reward and punishment? Are we not to do things that please us? Well, of course we're to do things that please us. I've said in other lectures for the teaching company, I've reminded students of H.L. Mencken's definition of Puritanism as the haunting feeling that someone somewhere may be happy. There's very little in the ancient Greek world that's opposed to happiness. They do mix their wine 50-50 with water, but they drink a fair amount of it, and they wrestle in the nude, and they have dancing girls and all sorts of things, not to mention practices that that are less jovial. So this is not a vote against pleasure, nor is it a denial of the power of reward and punishment in shaping character. But of course, reward and punishment could only work if we had the capacity to choose. That is, absent all volition, we would never choose reward over punishment. So, in order for the Skinnerian project to be sound, a volitional component already has to be granted. The problem with pleasure is that some pleasures harm us. Some pleasures not only harm us, but they make it impossible for us to enjoy yet other pleasures. And the pleasures that the Greeks condemned were the pleasures that arose from acts that were immoral. And the reason they condemned these is not by way of a kind of circular argument. An act came to be judged as immoral when it was at variance with the very possibility of a flourishing human life. The addict is pleased by the source of his addiction. The tyrant is pleased by tyrannizing over others. The sadist is pleased by inflicting punishment on others. What has to be kept in mind in examples like this is the life that can't be lived by such persons. The tyrant becomes an addict of his own power and thus loses the refining influence of adversaries. Quite apart from the question of what tyranny does to those who are tyrannized by it, look what it does to the tyrant himself. He now is bereft of critics and all of the self-improvement that comes about thereby. Similarly with acts of cruelty. Apart from the question of the pain and suffering caused to others, look at what one does to oneself by inflicting it. Look at what kind of being one becomes when one does that sort of thing. And some pleasures come to have such a profound effect and control on the actor that, in fact, the actor soon loses all autonomy. The classic instance, of course, is the drug addict. The question no longer is whether the drugs please. The question is whether the addict would have any choice in the matter just in case the drugs did not please. And what happens once that autonomy is sacrificed? Well, to sacrifice one's autonomy is no longer to be capable of deliberated choice. Now, where one is incapable of deliberated choice, the Greek word for that is prohairesis. Where one has forfeited prohairesis, then one's actions are determined by sources entirely external to oneself. We have a word for such a being. Does anybody know what that word is? The word is a slave. We have created a slave, not a slave by nature, but a slave by self-imposition. Now, the modern world contains perhaps a wider variety of addicting substances than the ancient world did. Substances that render daily life more serene and complacent. Aristotle said the greatest threat to the state is not faction, but distraction. And our distractions are taking on the property of addicting agents, and the ancient Greek world knew the wages of that kind of event. Thank you.